Gators Breakdown, the Gators Fan Podcast, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown Podcast is ready to go. I'm your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SCC. I am joined this week by co-host Will Miles. You can find him at readandreaction.com and on Twitter at Will Miles SCC. Man, Will, that I was going to try and take it a little easy last week, just do one draft show. Then the theatric facing interview was so good, I split it up into another episode, and CJ Henderson gets drafted by the Jaguars, so kind of a local angle here with News for Jack. So ended up doing three episodes last week in what I thought would be a light week.
Yeah, well, nobody's complaining about having more content these days since there's nothing else really going on. I guess that's one of the nice parts about the draft and the NFL keeping the draft in when they did is that, there's stuff to talk about. And the draft is always sort of about hope anyway. So it's kind of fun in the times that we're in right now to talk about hope, talk about the football season, talk about what teams are going to do, and particularly how the Gators are going to fit into that.
Yeah, and to do that, we'll kind of lay out our thoughts of what the NFL did last week as well as far as the new virtual draft. But to help us break it all down, also joining us on this episode as we take a look back at the 2020 NFL draft is Tyler Moss of the Fantasy Stock Exchange. Tyler, thanks for hopping on to help give us a look at these Gators in the NFL.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I mostly work with fantasy content, but I'm a huge Gator fan. Love monitoring the SEC and always love Gator football. It's what I grew up on. So very excited to be on the podcast today with you.
All right, gentlemen. Yeah, so I kind of alluded to it. And last week was hopefully the last virtual draft we'll have to deal with. It was kind of weird. And Roger Goodell, I think they did the best they could given what they had to deal with. And everybody, look, I work at a TV station, so I know exactly how hard it is to try and do everything virtual right now. So as big as the NFL is, Will, man, I thought they did a good job. It was just, you kind of just lost the emotion of it. And Roger Goodell even joked about it a good bit. He missed hugging the players and the players walking up and trying the hats on and following from the green room and all that kind of stuff. And the drama, not a lot of trades. I don't know if the virtual aspect played into that, but the drama was kind of lacking as well.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think we all kind of expected, or at least I think some of us were maybe thinking there might be some more technical glitches and some things that went on. In fact, they had some technical glitches when they did their dry run. So at the time I was like, well, they're going to have to invite their kids over for dinner so that they can be tech support afterwards for the draft. But, I guess we learned a few things. One is that Goodell has a basement that really isn't any nicer than most of us. And, it was interesting that they had Goodell be the MC for the event as opposed to having somebody in as a host to do that sort of thing. I was a little bit surprised. I thought maybe they'd have somebody other than him. But, I think the NFL struck a pretty good tone. It's a celebration of the league. It's a celebration of sort of the interaction with college football. But at the same time, it's a little bit of a muted time just because of the coronavirus. I think they sort of struck the right balance and really gave people what they were craving. I mean, obviously, the ratings say that. So, pretty successful three-day stint for the NFL and certainly a lot for everybody to talk about.
Tyler, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, so, I mean, I thought there would be, maybe it was going to be a lot more trades or there was going to be a lot less. And I think early on we were seeing teams were kind of hesitant to move picks. But as the draft kind of got moving on and into day two and into day three, I think teams were more comfortable in moving off their picks and going back to what it was before. It definitely was different, but I think teams started getting adjusted to it. I don't really see it as a long-term solution either. I know that was kind of in some talks. It's definitely a one-year thing if it can stay to a one-year ordeal. So I'm ready to go back to the players being there and the more drama and fan experience for it.
Especially when you go to the fan experience that was Nashville a year ago and you saw how, what was it? Is it Broadway is what they call it down there, downtown Nashville, and how they filled that up in comparison. Yeah, we got Vegas would have been fun and seeing how they do that. So good for Vegas to get the draft back in a couple years. But that's Yeah, you definitely, especially going, seeing that stark change from a year ago, I think speaks volumes to, you know, kind of the situation that we're in.
Yeah,
there'll be some interesting, I'm sure it'll be like, you know, the XFL a few years ago when the first time it started, there were some things the NFL took from that experience, in particular the camera that's sort of above everybody. You know, and obviously I'm not sure anybody could watch football without that behind view camera that you get with the camera that's on the pulleys anymore. And so I suspect they'll take a couple of things that they thought worked well. You do wonder whether the war rooms will sort of shrink down because they had to do it with sort of a skeleton crew this year. And I'm sure there are organizations that'll think that that was a better way to go, and they may end up doing that in the future. But certainly looking forward to the fountains and the boats taking the players over to hug Goodell and all that sort of stuff. Just because, I mean, it's a pageant, right? And you know, nobody wins or loses any games. It's sort of like the NFL's equivalent of National Signing Day, and so it's fun and it's interesting to talk about. But certainly without the pageantry, it does feel like there's a little bit missing.
Yeah. Tyler, before we get started, man, let us know and let our listeners know what the Fantasy Stock Exchange is all about.
Yeah, so I'm a co-founder of the channel. We're relatively new. It's fantasy football oriented, Dynasty Devi, which is involving college players, redraft as well. So it's mainly circled around fantasy content, but we do go over this past. We just put out a rookie guide, Fantasy Stock Exchange rookie guide. We just put out and that we wanted to make 100% free. We wanted our viewers to get as much from that as possible. FSEDraftGuide.com is where you can find it 100% free. Again, breaking down all the players that we find fantasy relevant. And more to that, I'm just overall a football fan, and you know, I'm a huge Gator fan, so I'm really excited to be talking Gator football and Gator landing spots today.
Awesome. 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 So, we'll get into the NFL draft here and our thoughts of, you know, how these players fit into their new teams and some Gators news and notes dealing with the draft. But before we get there, remember you can find Gators Breakdown on news4jax.com/Gators Breakdown. You'll find all the Gators Breakdown episodes as well as News4Jax coverage of the Gators. And as I mentioned, if you missed last week, interview with Siatric Faison, really good interview and his time at Florida. And then on Friday, Culpepper, News4Jax sports anchor, and I broke down CJ Henderson getting picked by the local Jacksonville Jaguars. So a lot of, you know, good discussion there as far as, yeah, the first round pick for the Jaguars. Also catch the podcast on all the popular podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Apple, all that good stuff. And follow Gators Breakdown on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Gators Breakdown. So, reviewing the 2020 NFL draft here, 7 Gators selected in the 2020 draft. CJ Henderson, first round pick, 9th overall to the Jaguars. Van Jefferson, second round pick, 57th overall to the Rams. Jabari Zuniga, third round, 79th overall to the New York Jets. Jonathan Greenard goes in the third round as well, with 90th overall to the Houston Texans. The New York Jets picked up LaMichael Perine with the 120th pick in the draft, while Freddie Swain and Tyree Cleveland were selected by Seattle and the Denver Broncos with the 214th and 252nd picks, respectively. So, with those 7 picks, the Gators finish only behind LSU with 14, Michigan and Ohio State with 10, and Alabama with 9 for the most draft picks in the 2020 NFL draft. Florida was also tied with Clemson and Georgia, who also had 7 picks apiece. So, Will, you take a look at that list, and only Florida and Michigan are teams that haven't reached the college football playoff yet. Florida's just right behind those, you know, other schools in fighting for a coveted college football playoff spot. And number of draft picks is just one metric we can look at, you know, to say Florida just might be a little closer to those schools and just looking for a few more elite players to get up there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about Mullen and bringing in transfers, especially this year with Lingard and Shorter and all those guys coming in. And you look at this list of the 7 guys, and 2 of them are transfers, right? So you've got Greenard and you've got Van Jefferson, 2 of the top 3 guys coming in who are transfers. So I do think it says something about the Mullen's ability to sort of cull from that market and be able to develop there. But, you know, CJ Henderson, obviously, we all sort of thought he was a first-round pick last year and didn't do anything to hurt his stock, so he's up there really high and sort of helps perpetuate that DBU moniker that Florida likes to argue with LSU about. And I think having three wide receivers is a big deal too, because you know, Mullen even said it in his sort of Zoom meeting with the press this week, that having that getting guys to buy in to have the ball spread around, but getting them all drafted means that it's a whole lot easier to convince the next group of guys coming in that having the ball go, you know, get split amongst multiple guys is not necessarily something that's going to hurt their long-term prospects. So a very positive 3 days for Florida.
Tyler, you think so too? You know, of course, everybody likes to compare when you're looking at NFL draft. The SEC themselves just dominated the draft. But here you have, you know, Florida. Everybody wants to know kind of, you know, peg Florida, you know, 2 years ago coming from Jim McElwain, and then success, 21 wins under Dan Mullen. The success, you know, for the draft hasn't really slowed down for Florida, you know, whether they're winning or losing.
Yeah, I mean, it was an impressive draft by for Florida and who they were bringing in. Van Jefferson, I thought in the second round was like honestly shocking to me. I was very much bought into him as a fantasy value, and obviously being a Florida fan, I very much liked him for the Gators. So him going in the second round was very, very surprising. It meant that teams were understanding of the volume that had to be spaced out between multiple different receivers there. And people got behind Van Jefferson as a talent. They're like, you know what, if we give him a little bit more volume, we think he can take up that next step and really play a value for us in the NFL. And then other receivers like Swain in Cleveland, another guys that I think teams were willing to take the risk on because of the Dan Mullen system and the proven Gator offense, that these guys are fighters. They're used to having to deal with a lot of competition and they're competitors. So you can take a guy on your team like that. They will compete for you and you'll get great value out of that. So I was very, very happy with all the Gator players that were able to go off.
All right, a couple notes before we break down the players here. Florida's the only SEC school and one of just four schools nationally to have had at least one player selected in every draft since 1967, the common era of the draft. Of that group, Florida, with 265, has the second most players drafted, with USC with 343 ahead of Florida. And Michigan, 264, Michigan State at 193, trailing the Gators. Florida's total 7 picks in this year's draft is the most by the Gators since 2017. It was also the 8th time since 2000 that the Gators had at least 7 players drafted. Additionally, Florida has had at least 5 players selected for the 6th straight year. So let's take a look here at how these players fit into their new teams. And of course, I broke it down a lot last week, but C.J. Henderson was the first pick. And, you know, want more thoughts on it, you can go check out last week too, but let's get Will and Tyler's thoughts here. You know, simply put, Jaguars had a lot of needs and could have went anywhere with this pick. No more Jalen Ramsey, no more A.J. Bouye. Tyler, the Jags are getting a good player that can run with the best of them.
Yeah, I think they're getting a very effective player in C.J. Henderson. You can't deny the vacation of the two players that left Jacksonville, A.J. Bouye going to the Broncos, and Ramsey obviously traded midseason to the Rams. So there's a lot of things that are missing, and cornerback was definitely a need that needed to be filled to replace those two guys. A lot of vacated tackles, a lot of targets that were thrown at those two players, a total of 107 overall targets to those players, 117, my apologies. Tackles wise, are sitting around 82. I mean, these guys were getting targeted when they were playing, because they were the main two corners for Jacksonville. So Henderson's going to have to step on and be the most effective corner for them. He's going to have to play the one, and I think he can do it. I think he can step up and be the one instantly on an offense. Obviously, that's what he was dealing with Florida.
Well, man, the big knock, and a lot of people are, of course, hitting CJ with, hey, he can't tackle, or he's got a lack of tackling. Look, that was an issue in 2019, but, man, as much as we preview Florida and talk Florida, especially going into last year, I don't ever remember that necessarily being an issue talking, you know, in regards to CJ Henderson before last season. And of course, the whole team had trouble tackling Miami in the first game of the season, and he obviously contributed there. Look, I get the knock because it definitely was one in 2019, but I just really don't, you know, I don't remember it being such of a knock going into the last season.
No, I think the tackling stuff is sort of, you see him in Miami in that game, and then every time he misses one after that, it's sort of exacerbated because you sort of have that in your mind. But here's the reality is, when you're a cornerback, the least important thing that you have to do is tackle. I mean, it's something you need to be able to do. It's something you need to be willing to do, but it's the least important of the skills. And that's why he was taken ninth overall. And you know, if you're an elite cover corner, that gets you to the Pro Bowl. If you're making the Pro Bowl, nobody cares if you don't want to tackle. And you know, Deion Sanders is maybe the best example of that. I mean, he's one of the guys that's considered one of the best corners of all time. And that guy shied away from tackling like you wouldn't believe. So I think one, it's overblown. I also think the other thing is that, you know, everybody knew Henderson was a top 10 talent after his sophomore season, and he just wasn't eligible for the draft. And, you know, there probably is a little bit of something in the back of his mind that he doesn't want to get injured in his junior season. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he sat out the bowl game. So I do think there's probably a little bit of that going on too. And, you know, after looking at the film against Miami, I'm sure that he was mm-hmm. displeased, and so came back. And the game against Auburn in particular, I remember him being a real good tackler. So I think he's willing. I think he's capable. I just think it's a matter of making sure that he's in the right mindset to be physical. But again, I think for a corner, that's not really the most important thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's move on here. And next pick here, Van Jefferson. I think great fit here for Jefferson going to the Rams. A little earlier than most saw him going. There was a run on wide receivers in the second round, and that was only going to help Jefferson going into an offense here with the Rams. You know, likes to spread the ball around. Jefferson was drafted with the selection of the Rams, but, you know, picked up by, you know, trading receiver Brandon Cooks. So, you know, Jefferson could play a big role in this slot. Tyler, in the slot is where I think he'll make his money in the NFL. He's got experience playing out wide with Florida, and they may move him there too. But I think in the NFL, he fits more of a mismatch type in the slot.
Yeah, Cooper Kupp's there right now for the Rams, sitting in their slot. I think that's a guy they could look to move past. I think his contract's up in 2 years, so he's definitely going to grow into a role there. There's a lot of vacated targets from Brandon Cooks, who we know was traded to Houston in the offseason. So I think Van Jefferson's going to find himself a good amount of targets for the team. I think he's going to need that amount of targets. He had 70 in his 2019 season for Florida. So that's just in a 13 game sample size. So we know that he's going to need the volume. So I want to see him get that volume to be productive as a fantasy receiver. But overall, to the Rams, I think it's a very good fit for him. He gets to learn behind Kupp in a very, very good offensive playbook. I'm really excited to see what he can do. And like you touched on, the capital spent on him was absolutely appalling in my eyes. I didn't think he would go until back third. So him getting that kind of draft capital is going to make him used fairly quickly in the Rams offense. So I'm very excited to see what McVay draws up for him.
Will, man, you mentioned it earlier with Jefferson. And look, Dan Mullen's second pick in the draft was a guy who's only been with the program for 2 years. We know this is he was not recruited by Jim McElwain. He went to Ole Miss before Dan Mullen pulled him away to Florida here. So, you know, a Jim McElwain guy goes first, but a transfer that you brought in to change the offense, bring it from ranked in the hundreds before you got here, and then, you know, the first receiver off the board for the Gators goes in the second round.
Well, I mean, I think that's the key, right? Is that Jefferson is an offensive player going high in the draft, and I think it was a stat I heard that the last time Florida had a guy go as high as Jefferson was Tim Tebow. back in 2010. So, I mean, you know, it's been a long time since Florida's had an offensive guy up that high, and no wonder they've struggled with recruiting guys at you know, elite receivers when they haven't really had anybody going in the draft. And from a fantasy perspective, I think actually, I mean, it's a great point that he was drafted in the second round, and so they're going to have to utilize him. But he's also 6'2", and I don't think Kupp is that big. And so, you know, 6'2", you do wonder whether they're going to utilize him down in the red zone a lot more. You know, particularly even putting him out wide, because he does have the ability to generate separation in one-on-one coverage. That's really the one thing that everybody has been pretty consistent about Jefferson about, is that when he gets somebody in one-on-one coverage, he has the moves and he has the ability to get him on his hip and be able to beat him. Doesn't necessarily have the straight line speed that you would want in a truly elite wide receiver, but you know, he had 8 explosive plays last year on those 70 targets. So, but you know, if the guy I maybe would compare him to is an Adam Thielen for Minnesota. Like, that's kind of what I'm thinking in terms of what he might be in the NFL.
Yeah. And just to touch more on that red zone effect. I mean, my favorite play from Van Jefferson the whole season was right there at the end of the almost the end of the second quarter there against LSU when he had that cut in as a slot receiver for that touchdown score with about 4 seconds left. That play was incredible. Just what he was able to do to create any space possible that close on the red zone. That's one of my highlight plays from him. And yeah, that provides that Thielen kind of aspect. I think the one issue though, is he demands a lot of targets to be effective, to be an effective receiver in fantasy. There's only 72 vacated targets in the Rams offense, all coming from Brandon Cooks. So I'd be interested to see if he takes any targets away from Kupp or Woods, at least in his first season. I think he's built to be a very good long-term receiver fantasy-wise for the Rams offense, but I want to see what he can do in this first season if he gets that rapport with Goff. See, that's the issue with the coronavirus. The time that they're going to have together to build that rapport between the quarterback and the wide receiver is going to be limited. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see if there's an effect played.
Definitely something we'll have to look out for, especially with, you know, Florida's got three receivers we'll discuss. And that's going to be an issue there for all of them and all the teams out there. So let's go back to a year ago and the Jets are drafting Ja'Kai Polite. And Will, man, that didn't work out too well for the Jets there. So
it didn't work out too well for Polite either.
No, it did not. It did not. But hey, look, that didn't deter them from drafting another Florida pass rusher in Jabbar Zuniga. You know, even with a very limited 2019, Zuniga gets drafted by a team with a huge need for a pass rusher. Zuniga has the look, has the attributes of what NFL teams are looking for in a pass rushing defensive end. Well, was it surprising to you a bit that Zuniga went before Grenard?
I mean, it was. I think he's, from a physical perspective, maybe is a little bit more gifted than Grenard, but Grenard's really the guy who slid into the role that was abandoned by Polite, and maybe the Jets are sort of banking on the fact that Zuniga is a reason that Grenard and Polite were both so effective, at least when Zuniga was on the field. The biggest thing for me is that last year against Georgia, obviously, Zuniga was injured and not himself. But even 2 years ago, we remember the red zone stand, but he didn't have any sacks, and he only had two tackles for loss in those games. And Jake Fromm was really comfortable in both of those games, particularly in 2019. And you do have to wonder whether he's going to be able to beat elite offensive linemen at the NFL level. But at the same time, he's going to get an opportunity to with the Jets because they obviously have a spot to fill. It'll be interesting to see when he's fully healthy, when he comes into a season where he's not hampered, is he going to be able to be that elite pass rusher? I'd be surprised if he turns into a guy who's got 12 or 13 sacks in a year. I think he's more of a situational pass rusher, but he is really good at setting the edge against the run. They did actually move him inside a little bit during the season as well.
And especially for the Georgia game, because he was a little banged up. So I think they tried to help him out and move him a little inside.
Yeah, and so you wonder whether that versatility is going to allow him to, whether that's something maybe the Jets thought was unique, is being able to move him inside. And if he's got the pass rush moves to rush the passer from the inside, that can be a real benefit to a team like the Jets.
Yeah, and speaking towards that, the opportunity 100% will be there. He's gonna replace Henry Anderson, who was the other end to the other side of Quinnen Williams. Quinnen Williams, the 2019 first round selection for the Jets. So you're gonna have both those two, Williams and Zuniga, on the edge again, setting the run. I mean, Williams will get after the quarterback. I still think he can do it. 6.5 sacks in 2018 when he was fully healthy. So I can get behind that. Zuniga will provide an effect for the Jets' pass rush. Mostly run stopping is definitely going to be the value for him. He's going and replacing a guy who one sack, 11 tackles in a season of play where he played 13 games. So you're definitely replacing a guy who you'll automatically step up and be the better option for the team. So they're going to put their weight on you to do work. And still, Quinnen Williams on the other side, he's going to be the defense's attention. So Zuniga could provide a sneaky value pick there at the 79th pick in the draft.
Okay, next up is Jonathan Grenard to the Houston Texans. And Tyler, man, he has to be excited to be on the same defense as J.J. Watt, him garnering so much attention. Could that just aspect of alone, that aspect alone, could that open up things for Grenard to make an early impact?
I think he definitely will have an impact. Watt, with his injury history, is just, it's nerve-wracking. So whether or not when Watt's on the field, yes, I do believe that there will be some eyes turned away from Grenard to go and make plays. But Watt, with his injury history, it's just nerve-wracking for me to see if he plays even a full season. I doubt he will. But he did have, talking in Grenard's stake, he did have a career year at Florida. I mean, he had, coming in as a transfer, absolutely incredible player for Florida. I actually had him over Zuniga, at least in my rankings. I love him as coming off of both the outside linebacker and the D-end role. I think he will play D-end for Houston. He's going to probably replace Angelo Blackson. Played 15 games, zero sacks. So it's another Gator player who's going to a situation where he'll clearly have a role. It will take him out of the outside linebacker position, but I definitely think he can play the D-end role as well. And it's a clear need for the team. They lost Clowney to the Seattle last year, so they needed that guy to come in. They didn't draft one last year. And with J.J. Watt's injury history, we touched on it, they're going to need a guy that can still get after the quarterback and cause fear and make the pass rush just a little bit more scary. And everything we know about Grenard is he's an absolute workhorse, and he's going to go out there and he's going to try and make plays on every single down. I absolutely love him going to the spot.
Yeah, I think the thing that surprises me about Grenard when I actually looked at it is he's heavier than Zuniga. And when I think about last year in particular, I think he showed more quickness, at least when he was trying to get to the quarterback, and really sort of was a terror against Auburn, and just Bo Nix was shaken during that game. And then against Virginia with Bryce Perkins, he was back there in the backfield a lot. Pretty strong against the run. Had a pretty slow 40 time, which I think scared some teams off in some capacity and probably allowed him to drop to the Texans. So I think the third round's probably about right for him. So yeah. I'd be really surprised if at some point in his career he doesn't have 10 sacks in a season. The thing I would caution people against is that the Texans aren't going to be able to score now that DeAndre Hopkins isn't there. And so how often is the opposing team going to be behind, and is he going to be able to pin his ears back and go after the quarterback? I think that's maybe one of the things that people would need to watch there in terms of his production in the NFL, but certainly he's going to get an opportunity. I mean, Watt obviously you mentioned his injury history earlier, but just they don't have anybody at defensive end. He's going to be able to step right in. I suspect that they're going to have him out there on the field early, and that he's going to have to prove that he can stay on the field for all three downs. But at least he was able to do that at Florida, and I think those skills will translate.
I mentioned it last week in the preview. I think my most intriguing player for this draft for the Gators is going to be LaMichael Perine, just because of doing so well in 2018 in the run game, and then the stats falling off, mainly because we know the offensive line couldn't open up enough holes for him, and kind of opening up himself in the passing game a bit in 2019. So he'll get to go and join Zuniga for the Jets, and a few other Gators there in New York now. Le'Veon Bell's already there and should get a bulk of the carries, but, he's going into an offense that can use his versatility, and I think there's some value here in Perine on third downs and in the red zone, Tyler.
Yeah, well, I mean, just starting with Bell, I mean, he had a career down year. Gase talked about it before the 2019 season that he wasn't really too thrilled that they spent that much money on Bell. I don't really think I think he'll play this year, but I don't think going into a 2021 season, Bell's really locked for that role. They've been looking to trade him since that 2019 comment when Adam Gase was not too thrilled about bringing him in. 3.2 average rushing. That's not going to get it done at the NFL level. I think Perine can come in and be a really good change of pace back. And Perine's used to always to being in a system where Damian Pierce took 54 touches last year. Malik Davis took 34, along with the quarterback mobility and what the quarterbacks were designed for to run. So Perine's used to being in a multi-back system. And I think that's what he could walk into with the Jets. They have no other guy. They let Bilal Powell walk. There's no real other guy that's going to cause any competition. LaMichael Perine will step on as the two. And I think he's used to fighting for every single touch he gets. So I think that's what he'll go in and do for the Jets. He definitely could get some red zone work. I could see that happening.
Well, Tyler brings up a good point there. Of course, 2018, more so than last year, almost 50-50 split with Jordan Scarlett.
Yeah, absolutely. And 2 years ago with Scarlett, he and Scarlett basically had the same yard per carry average. This year, Pierce had a little bit higher average, but Pierce was obviously in games after the defense had been sort of softened up a little bit by Perine, because early on the defense was typically in the backfield against Florida's offensive line this past season. But the reason that Perine went in the fourth round is because he can catch the ball. And, you know, so when you think about him being the number two running back with the Jets, but specifically when you think about fantasy from a PPR perspective in those sorts of leagues, I think he might have some real value because he's going to be a target. I mean, that was really a huge deal for Mullen's offense was being able to have Pirine and Pitts in, you know, in the 11 personnel and then just split them both out wide. And all of a sudden you've got defensive backs. You've either got defensive backs on guys who are bigger and stronger, or you've got linebackers on guys who are faster and quicker. And he's going to be able to contribute that sort of thing to the Jets offense right away, even if he struggles to sort of, you know, even if he's not a dynamic back out of the backfield.
Yeah, I just think, you know, I said it in the preview last week, Will and Tyler. I mean, just barely remember, even last year when the offensive line for Florida struggled, him getting tackled for a loss of yardage. He always finds a way to make, you know, a yard or two, even if the blocking's not there, wiggle his way. He doesn't take a whole lot of lost yardage plays. So I think that's it's a minor thing, but, you know, maybe another value teams can look at.
Absolutely. I barely touched on the receiving. I mean, that's there as well. And one issue with Florida last year was finally getting going in the running game. They started to see it at the end with the line. I think Pirine really had potential to do a lot more. The hindrance of the line, though, was holding him back. I think going into the Jets system, I think he's going to get opportunity. Adam Gase does like to run multi-backs, so he's going to be a much better option than what Adam Gase was dealing with last year. We had Bilal Power and Ty Montgomery. Ty Montgomery was a wide receiver transformed into a running back, so you already know what you're kind of getting out of Pirine from the running aspect and the receiving aspect as well. I think he could definitely steal some third down work from Bell, which would hurt Bell's fantasy value, but it would definitely provide some sneaky handcuff and just overall value from LaMichael Pirine.
All right. So one of the biggest questions for the Gators in this draft, if not the biggest, was where, you know, Florida's deep wide receiver core would get drafted. It took some time behind Van Jefferson, but Freddie Swain gets put in a great situation out in Seattle with Russell Wilson. Will, you and I were talking over the weekend, and you really like this fit. I know I bring this play up a lot when discussing Swain, but the catch and run versus Tennessee in 2018, Franks escapes the pocket, found Swain, he runs away from Tennessee players. I mean, that's the type of play I see something a good bit of. You know, Russell Wilson freelancing, creating plays, and you know, finding a streaking, you know, Freddie Swain, and they're like, plays like that are something I can see, you know, maybe Seattle getting with Russell Wilson teaming up with Freddie Swain.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is really one where I think Mullen should be crowing a little bit, because under McElwain, Swain and Hammond, both of those guys in particular, really didn't do a whole lot within the offense, and all of a sudden he was a revelation once Mullen came into the program. You know, the interesting thing is I mentioned that Van Jefferson had 8 explosive last year on 70 targets. Over the last 2 years, Swain's had 14 explosives on 78 targets. So he's a lot more explosive player than I think we give him credit for, which is interesting because he doesn't seem all that explosive mm-hmm. on punt returns. But the minute they get the ball in his hands on a slant, or like you mentioned on that play against Tennessee where it broke down, you know, he really has the ability to take the ball the distance, and he showed that with his 40 time. I think he was like a 4.46 or something like that for his 40 time. So he's got real good straight line speed, and then the fact that he was I wouldn't say he was an explosive punt returner, but he was an excellent punt returner in that he did not make mistakes. He fair caught when he was supposed to. He didn't fumble the ball. He's going to get on the field just as a special teamer right away, and then have the ability to grow into a larger role. And Seattle in particular is a team that they took DK Metcalf a couple of years ago in the second round, but they have not relied on first round wide receivers really that much that I can recall. And they've really developed guys, you know, guys like Tyler Lockett and that sort of stuff from, you know, internal. And so I suspect Swain's really going to get an opportunity to grow within that program.
Tyler, before you jump in here, man, it's now we're getting into, you know, these late picks and these guys are on offense. Not really a lot of fantasy value out there unless you're just in some deep, deep, deep leagues.
Yeah, not necessarily, but really what you're looking for when you find these deep, deep wide receivers is, will they be able to provide any sort of value? And what will they be able to do with that value and with anything that they can do for the team? So obviously special teams, when you're looking very deep at a wide receiver core, you look at, can they provide an effect on special teams? And I think Swain can. Seattle already announced that's what they plan on using him to do and having him grow into a wide receiver role. Only one punt return touchdown for the Gators, for Swain, but I think he has that explosive ability to make plays in that punt return game. They need that piece. I think he's coming in fighting for the fourth spot for the fourth receiver. So he can not only provide that return game value, but he's competing with David Moore and Philip Dorsett as the 3-4 in Seattle. So I think he can definitely find his way into the starting offense come probably the end of the year. There's probably not too much value this year, but definitely look to see what he can do in the return game and look to see what he can do with battling out David Moore and Philip Dorsett. Philip Dorsett's on a 1-year deal as well. So there's not a commitment to him. They drafted Swain with a pick. Unlike undrafted guys, they clearly see a value in taking him. So interested to see what Swain grows into.
All right, and last one for the Gators. Tyree Cleveland gets drafted by the Broncos, and going to be tough to make headway there on a loaded depth chart, but a depth chart that didn't really get all that loaded until this past weekend when Denver also drafted Alabama's Jerry Jeudy, 15 overall, and Penn State's KJ Hamler, 46th overall. So Cleveland's going to have to come in and prove he can hang somewhat with those guys. One plays Will, and then you guys both just mentioned it, you know, the right attitude and experience to be successful in special teams for Tyree Cleveland. We've seen him out there just enjoying the game of football the last couple of years with the coaching change, running with players down the field with long score touchdowns or running with them on the sideline. A guy who's really enjoyed football the last couple of years, a gunner on special teams as well. So if much like Swain, but maybe in a different fashion, going to have to make his way, I think, on special teams first and foremost.
Yeah, I think Cleveland's career at Florida, it was a little bit underwhelming, really, when you look at sort of the hype when he came in and when McElwain flipped him. It was a pretty significant deal right on signing day there, if my memory serves me correctly. But his unselfishness is something that I think really has stuck out and really stuck out for this entire wide receiver group. And this is one of those times, you know, when you're in the seventh round and you've already drafted two wide receivers early, you need a guy who's just going to come in and grit and grind. And Cleveland fits that profile. But he also fits that profile from the standpoint of he's got significant talent. It just wasn't something that necessarily got unlocked in a big way at Florida other than the heave to Cleve against Tennessee after the hurricane. But, you know, I think that's the thing is you look at somebody, he's fast, he's big, he's strong. He ran pretty good routes when he was there at Florida. He just wasn't somebody who got utilized a whole lot for whatever reason. And so, you know, I understand why the Broncos would take a flyer on him, particularly knowing that he's not going to be an issue, that he's not going to be really, I mean, he'll be pushing for reps, but he's not going to be complaining if he doesn't get them.
Yeah, and I think the whole goal for Denver in this class is they came in with Deshaun Hamilton and Courtland Sutton, and that was it. Sutton, a breakout player, but Deshaun Hamilton, really not a reliable two wide receiver at all. They drafted Jerry Jeudy early in the first round, and then they went right back to receiver with their next pick by getting KJ Hamler. They go with Tyree Cleveland, too, so they get three wide receivers in this class. I think their goal is to see who's going to hit and who can be relied on for this offense in the future. They also obviously have Noah Fant, too, at the tight end position. So they're giving Drew Lock as many targets as possible to work with. I think the whole goal, though, is for every team in this division is Tyreek Hill is on the Chiefs. And the Raiders, they tried to emulate that by going with Henry Ruggs. Denver tries to do the same thing. They get a KJ Hamler. They're just trying to see if any of these guys can kind of pan out and be that dominant effect for their offense. I think Tyree Cleveland definitely can find a role for them, definitely in the return game if he can fight out KJ Hamler. But I think the opportunity is there because there's no proven receivers outside of Courtland Sutton in that offense. You can't count the rookies yet because Jerry Jeudy and KJ Hamler have yet to take a snap with Drew Lock. So I think that there's definitely a competition. I would love to see what happens. I kind of would like to compare it to when the Broncos had Philip Lindsay and they had Royce Freeman last year or a couple years ago. And Philip Lindsay came in as an undrafted free agent close to about where Cleveland's at as a seventh rounder. And Royce Freeman had that second round value and Lindsay takes the job. So I think Denver is plenty okay with going with the best option, not really worried about draft capital, which I think is definitely in Tyree Cleveland's favor.
All right. So that is a look for the Gators that were drafted there. But of course, guys that don't get drafted get signed undrafted free agents, and Gators had a few of those guys as well. Tommy Townsend, punter, looks to be the punter for Kansas City now after they picked him up as an undrafted free agent. And then on Tuesday, Kansas City released Dustin Colquitt after 15 seasons. So Townsend gets in there and looks to be the punter this coming up season for the Kansas City Chiefs. Josh Hammond signed here with the Jaguars. David Reese to the Carolina Panthers, and defensive tackle Adam Schuler to Arizona. So before we let Tyler go, let's take a peek at 2021. Never too early, right? I mean, a year away. So, of course, you know, as soon as the draft is over, you see, you start seeing mock drafts for 2021. So, just peek there, and look, some names for Florida that will be floated around the next year or so. Of course, Kyle Pitts start right there. Kyle Trask, Marco Wilson, T.J. Slayton, Trevon Grimes, Jeremiah Moon, maybe Brenton Cox if he has a dominant season. You know, he'll be draft eligible to transfer from Georgia there. So looked at a few 2021 mock drafts from publications like CBS Sports, NBC Sports, Walter Football. None of them have any Gators going in the first round. That includes Kyle Pitts there. So, look, the Gators have had 10 first-round picks in the last 8 drafts. And a lot of these mock drafts, you know, only just one round there. So, you know, 10 first-round picks in the last 8 drafts for the Gators. Florida has had a first-round pick in 12 of the last 14 years. So if these mocks somewhat hold true, then those mocks would take a hit. But, you know, let's be honest. These mocks would change a lot. Many mocks a year ago had Jake Fromm going in the first round and Joe Burrow amid the late rounder. So we see how quickly things can change and how that turned out. So, you know, but still an interesting look a year out from where they from what they think about Florida. You know, Florida only had one first-round pick this past season, and as of now, many not seeing having one next year, Will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense based on where you think. Like, typically first-round picks are quarterbacks, and you know, you sort of – there's nobody on the offensive line, so I don't suspect there's going to be an offensive tackle that's going to get drafted up that high. And just sort of the positions that you think of that people really emphasize in the first round, the only guy right now who's really sort of who sort of fits that profile is Kyle Pitts. But I mean, with an excellent season, I think he has an opportunity to jump up there, absolutely, especially as much emphasis as you're seeing on the tight end, and certainly down in Tampa, they're going to have Gronk showing people down there what a tight end can do. And you know, we saw it with Hernandez and Gronk in New England. So I do think that there's an opportunity for Pitts to jump up there. If Damian Pierce had a really big year, you could see him maybe sneaking into the bottom half of the first round. Slayton maybe, but defensive tackles are usually, they have to be truly, truly elite to get drafted up at that kind of level. So, I think Florida's team, and this is something that we sort of thought all along, is that this third year under Mullen, you've got sort of the transition in recruiting, and he's held on to some guys, he's brought in some transfers, but the transfers are the guys who are going to have to be the elite difference makers. So the guys like Lingard, the guys like Shorter, and the guys like Cox, and you know, those guys may end up being the guys who leave if they have fantastic seasons. But obviously that's something that you'd want, because if they have a fantastic season, then you figure that Florida's done really, really well.
Tyler, you and I were talking behind the scenes a little bit today. You're a big fan of one Kyle Pitts.
I am. So I'm a huge fan. Before I get into Kyle Pitts real quick, Marco Wilson, before he decided not to declare for the draft, was looking at around second round value. So going back for one more year, I think he definitely could sneak in into the first round. But Kyle Pitts is a guy that I could definitely compare to the Hockenson Fant draft from just a couple years ago. I think if he would have, now he wasn't eligible, but I think if he was to have gone in this past year's draft, I think he would have been the number one tight end off the board. I think that's just the value he has. Now this year was a down year for tight ends. Last year was just such an up year for them. I really, really like Kyle Pitts a ton. I think he has first round value if he can put together another really good season. I mean, he had defenses drawing up plays specifically for him, and with how talented our wide receivers were, it was opening up a lot for our offense. I absolutely love Kyle Pitts, and then I really like Kyle Trask as well. I think Trask could have could be a sneaky riser in draft boards. I think he has NFL starting ability. I got to see a little bit more for a full season for him this upcoming year. I'm really excited to see him as well. But Kyle Pitts is definitely a guy. Him and Marco Wilson are probably the highest chances to probably be in that first round.
All right. Tyler, man, I can't thank you enough for giving your NFL insight here. Gators breakdowns 99% Gator football. So, we get to talk a little NFL this time of year with the draft. Let our listeners know what you guys at the Fantasy Stock Exchange got coming up.
Yeah, so again, we just put out our rookie draft guide. Everyone in the class with fantasy value, fsedraftguide.com. You can find that. We've got our main full draft coming up as well. We're going to release that around 4th of July weekend. So that's in a little ways from now, but we're getting that working on. We got a lot of stuff going on. You can check out our YouTube. We're on most places you can find podcasts as well. If you guys want to hear us, a startup, but definitely something we're pumping out a lot of content for, 7 videos at least a week. So we're just trying to get as much content out for the viewer as possible. Very excited to keep that going. And I'm around on a lot of different places too, as well. A lot of different channels. I try and feature, as many places as possible. So hopefully you guys run into me, somewhere else as well. But, it was a really, really big pleasure, being on Gators Breakdown.
Thanks, man. Thanks. And, any way we can help out, we've all been there with the startups and all that stuff. So we get you out there and look, you know what you're talking about. So it's a big help in letting our NFL fantasy fans know what they're getting out of the Gators.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you.
All right, Will. So good stuff there as we take a look at the NFL draft from a Gator perspective here. And look, Will, you and I kind of alluded to it a bit here, of course. I mean, Mullen's going to be able to take this on the recruiting trail at somewhat. You can spin in a positive light what's been going on here the last couple of years with the 21 wins and now some success with the NFL draft as well. And last year, after one season, and you can say this for any school. How much is it the past coach and how much isn't the current coach? But as you get away from the hire, further and further away, you're going to start giving more credit to Dan Mullen. And after 2017, a lot of people will give Dan Mullen a lot of credit for last year's draft too. But, McElwain brought these players in, and, while we slam recruiting for the most part for not being up to Florida standards, still in, still okay recruiting for on a national scale, just not what we were used to seeing beforehand from a Florida Gators head coach on the recruiting trail. So Mullen taking McElwain's players, winning with them, turning them into NFL draftees, maybe even more credit for Mullen, is taking these transfers, Van Jefferson and Jonathan Grenard, that he only had for a season or two, and also turning them into NFL draft picks. I mean, Mullen can take this out and go shopping with it.
Yeah, he absolutely should. I mean, I looked at, I think it was last offseason, I looked at the development and the number of 2 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars, and 5 stars that Mullen had go into the NFL draft compared to sort of what the average was. And in each of those categories, his players made it to the NFL more often than sort of the average in college football. And I think that's indicative of his ability to develop the players and get them to be elite. Certainly when you've got 7 guys getting drafted and then you got another 3 or 4 who are being undrafted free agents who have the potential to represent the university in the NFL, it's a big deal because, if I'm a recruit, I'm looking at LSU and seeing 14 guys get drafted and saying, all right, that might be a place I want to go. And LSU just won the national championship. That's where Florida wants to get to. And so one of those steps is convincing recruits that you're going to get them to the next level. And that's why I said earlier that having all four wide receivers get a shot in the league, but having 3 of them get drafted, I think is a big deal because I do think that the unselfishness of Cleveland and Swain gave them a leg up when it came to teams that were considering taking them in the 5th, 6th, and 7th rounds. And that's something that I think that is going to help Mullen as, if somebody tries to negatively recruit and say, you're not going to get 80 catches, Mullen can come back at him and say, well, you're going to be healthy when you get to the NFL. And by the way, you're going to get there anyway. So he should absolutely use it for recruiting, anything he can do to help bump up the talent level. And, the issue with recruiting's never been there aren't talented players at Florida. It's always been that you're competing with the best of the best of the best when you compare it to Alabama, Georgia, and LSU, and so you need to be up at that level. And Mullen's slowly getting there.
All right, and Will, kind of to extend what you were just saying with those receivers, Swain and Cleveland's selection on Saturday, along with Jefferson's on Friday, marked the first time since 1978 that Florida had three wide receivers drafted in the same year. Florida joins Tennessee and LSU as the only schools in the SEC to have had three wide receivers selected in two separate drafts in the Common Draft era. Additionally, it was the first time since 2009 that more than one Florida wide receiver was selected the same year, and the fourth time since 2000. And that feat ranks second in the SEC. So, Will, kind of like you just said, for an offense that spreads the ball around so much and so many players that can be a knock on Mullen by some, three guys still get drafted. Kyle Pitts looking as a high draft pick next season. Mullen can definitely go shopping with that. Few other notes here about the draft before we move on. Florida ranks tied for first nationally among schools with the most wide receivers selected in the first three rounds during the Common Draft era, tied with 19 each among Tennessee and Ohio State. And for the sixth straight year, at least five Gators were selected. This is the 13th time since 2000 that the Gators had at least five Gators taken in the NFL draft. And Will, one more. The Gators' seven total drafted players represent the most in the state of Florida this year. Florida with seven draftees, Miami with four, FIU with two, FSU with one, UCF with one, Florida Atlantic one, South Florida zero. Florida leading the way here in the state of Florida, three more than Miami, six more than FSU, and Florida International with two, actually one more than FSU. So, I mean, look, only 2 years of Willie Taggart. A little of this goes to Jimbo Fisher as well. But, man, the development there the last 2 years, you can, I mean, for FSU fans and media out there that want to slam FSU for firing Willie Taggart after two seasons, well, this is one example that, anybody in support of firing Willie Taggart can take to the bank. One player drafted from FSU, and some of those were highly rated recruiting classes.
They were all highly rated recruiting classes. In fact, if you looked at pure talent overall, even the roster rankings, right? It's not like these guys have all transferred out. It's just they haven't developed. And, we've seen personally at Florida what kind of damage a two-year reign of terror can do, because we got, 2.5 years of the McElwain-Nussmeier regime, and things just sort of fell apart. Obviously, they never really even got started at Florida State under Taggart, which is significant considering how much talent that they actually had at that program and the guys that they brought in. But yeah, I mean, it says something about the difference between a high quality head coach and somebody who maybe isn't necessarily ready for prime time. And, I know Taggart's name was mentioned when it came to Florida's job. So, you think about Taggart, you think about Chip Kelly, and then Dan Mullen were sort of the three that you sort of heard getting bantered around, and whew, boy, did Florida pick the right guy there. But I want to go back to what you said about the wide receiver. When you think of the wide receivers being drafted, when you think about Florida and the program, and when the program has excelled, I mean, national championships have been surrounded by guys who are going in the first three rounds of the draft, right? So guys like Rashay Caldwell, Jacquez Green, Taylor Jacobs, Rashay Caldwell, Andre Caldwell, Percy Harvin, David Nelson, All the Riley Cooper, all those guys who became quality NFL players, or at least had an opportunity in the NFL, are tied in with Florida's offense being good, but also Florida just being excellent as a program. And so I do think that there's something you can read into having those three guys get drafted, having Hammond be an undrafted free agent, and now sort of having this next wave of guys coming in. If Mullen can keep that going, I think that's one of the things that that we really ought to look for, is that, it took Spurrier 4, 5, 6 years to break through to where he finally had teams that were going, 12-1, losing in that Fiesta Bowl in 95 and then winning the championship in 96. We've sort of talked this entire time that Mullen's ability to build the program is going to be more of a slow burn than a quick shot up. And I do think that if we see wide receivers step up in 2020, and really sort of excel the same way these guys did when Mullen took over from McElwain, I think that's a really good sign for the program moving forward.
Well, one more thing, and I'm going to connect some dots here. We mentioned mock drafts a little bit for 2021, and One name going in the first round that Gator fans have noticed is not a Gator, and that is one Georgia quarterback, Jamie Newman. And your latest at read and reaction, can he take over from? Can Jamie Newman, the transfer from Wake Forest, come in and step in for Jake Fromm and take Georgia to the next step? And Will, toward the end of your article, you know, the quote here, and I'll let you build off of this: Newman has the skills you need to be an elite quarterback, but has not been able to consistently apply them yet over a course of a season. So in your film review of one Jamie Newman, and everybody go to read and reaction and read and look at these highlights Will has pinpointed, what did you notice?
Newman's a really interesting case because when you're watching it, usually you watch a quarterback, and if you watch a full game, you sort of get an idea of what he does well and what he doesn't do well. And, you know, I watched a full game that he played against NC State because that was his best game of the season. And I left that game going, oh crap, we're in trouble. if that's his ceiling, we're in trouble. But then you look at his stats and you're like, and I even did that in the article. I compared 2019 Jamie Newman to 2018 Felipe Franks, and they're basically the same player. And if you think about the things that people said about Franks, it's like he's got a cannon for an arm. He just needs to learn how to read defenses, needs to not lock on to his first receiver. And those are the things you started to see when you looked a little bit deeper into what Newman was doing. He clearly locked on to Surratt and Hinton as two main receivers, and those guys accounted for like 50% of the total catches that Wake Forest had last year. And there were times where those guys would be open because the coverage dictated it, and he would make awesome throws to them. And then there would be times where they would be bracketed, and he would still try to throw it into them. And I think that's where sort of the disconnect between the stats that he's put up and what you see on film, because he's got a cannon for an arm. He's got an ability to run. He's able to take advantage. He's able to build, you know, there were some times, there was one example where he sort of danced around the pocket, made time, and then just threw a bullet to the outside and was able to convert a third down against Virginia Tech. He's got the skills. I understand why people look at it and say, this guy's going to be a great NFL quarterback. But you know, you and I have talked extensively about the work I've done looking back at high school accuracy, and his high school accuracy was terrible. It's been better in college, but it hasn't been elite by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, Georgia's bringing in a lot of new guys on offense this year, a brand new offensive coordinator, maybe they gel, but you also have the possibility that they don't at all because there hasn't been any ability to develop trust. And that's one of the things when you're, you know, Georgia's basically a national championship or bust at this point, right? I mean, an SEC title isn't even enough for their fans because they still have to hear 1980, mm-hmm. even if they win the SEC title and then flame out in the playoffs. And so at some point they're going to be down. And the question is, in the huddle, are they going to trust the quarterback? And I think, you know, 3 years ago against Alabama, Kirby Smart clearly didn't trust Jake Fromm. He took the ball out of his hands actually late and allowed Alabama to come back with Tua. And then even you look at that South Carolina game last year, I mean, Fromm played terribly and he didn't really play very well all year long, but you figure you got your junior quarterback who's really supposed to be your stud, and they really kind of took the ball out of his hands in that South Carolina game as well and cost him that game. So, you know, I do wonder, is there going to be a level of trust between Munkin and Smart and Newman and then all the players? And, you know, he's got all the skills that you would want to see, except for, like I said, I think he locked onto some guys and would force the ball in. And you see that in his interception total. So he had 26 touchdowns, 11 interceptions. That was really the difference between him and then Franks the year before, where Franks had 24 touchdowns and 6 interceptions. So Newman really didn't take care of the ball all that well with Wake Forest. And the offensive line at Wake Forest wasn't terrible. Like it wasn't something where you're like, oh yeah, he's getting hit all the time and that's going to change when he's at Georgia, so everything will get better. So I'm left not entirely sure what we're going to see out of Jamie Newman in 2020. Like, it's entirely possible that he wins the Heisman Trophy because he has those sort of skills. But I think that's a really, really low probability. I think the higher probability is that he ends up being about what we would have expected from Felipe Franks last year, which I think most of us thought coming into the year might be good enough to get Florida to be competitive with Georgia, but that was going to be a rough one. But that if Florida could pull that out, then they had an opportunity to make the playoff. But, you know, that's not good enough for Georgia now. And it's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out because, you know, you win the recruiting national championship the first couple of years that you're a head coach, and everybody pats you on the back and says, this is great, you're building, you know, we're hopeful that the program's going to take the next step. But, you know, Georgia's actually sort of receded the last couple of years, going from the national championship to just, you know, the SEC championship loss, and then not even making, or, you know, and then the SEC championship loss to LSU last year that wasn't even remotely competitive. So, yeah, I'm sure people in Athens are getting a little bit antsy, which is one of the reasons why they're pushing the Newman narrative. But I think there's some things that they need to be concerned about, and things that, especially because of the coronavirus, because the schedule might be condensed, and because they have to play Alabama, Auburn, and Florida next year, that there might be an opportunity for the Gators to get them.
Yep, and you know, Pro Football Focus is also one of those publications out there, kind of behind the hype train of one Jamie Newman. And since they like to give so much of the positive, I'll throw some negative out there too. So you did a little bit in your article there, Will. But his, you know, stats over his final five games: Virginia Tech, Clemson, Duke, Syracuse, and Michigan State in the bowl game. Now, don't get me wrong, I know injuries played a part here to him and his wide receivers to a point. In this stretch here, but here we go. 54 of 114 for a 47.4% completion percentage, 161.8 yards per game, 5 touchdown passes, 3 of those versus Michigan State in the bowl game, 4 interceptions, 3.28 yards per rush, 1 rushing touchdown, and 2 fumbles there in his final 5 games. So you bring that up to a lot of people, and the first thing, or, you know, the Georgia side, and the first thing they mention, oh, well, he'll have more talent at Georgia. And there was a lot of injuries he dealt with there and all that. Yeah, there is going to be more talent at Georgia. He will be surrounded by, you know, a offensive line that was recruited so well, but missing a lot of experience. Still a lot of questions at wide receiver for Georgia. And then, you know, replacing DeAndre Swift as well. Georgia has a lot of questions in switching to an offense with Todd Monken as well. But Will, I mean, you know, he's also going to be playing a lot better defenses in the SEC, as you already mentioned. Alabama, Auburn, and Florida he'll have to go against. South Carolina did so well against the Georgia offense last year as well. So, you know, he's gonna be playing. You know, he's not going to be just facing two top, 30 defenses that he faced in the SEC. He's going to be facing that, you know, probably almost every other week in the SEC.
Yeah, well, I think what's important is you listed the last 5 games that he played there. So Virginia Tech was 32nd in the country against the pass. Clemson was 3rd. Duke was 39th. Syracuse was 85th. And Michigan State was 29th. So out of those 5 teams, you know, you had 3 teams in the top 32, and that was when he struggled.
And yeah, I think he barely played in the Syracuse game, if I remember right.
Well, and then you look at everybody. Yeah, he had 13 attempts in that game. But then if you look at the teams that he built up all of his stats on, Utah State, 99th, Rice, 109th, North Carolina, 58th, Elon, FCS, Boston College, 107th, Louisville, 78th, and North Carolina State, 80th. So that's defensive yards per play allowed, which is what I typically like to look at from a defensive perspective. So basically, he played absolutely garbage defenses for the first 7 games of the year, and he looked fantastic. And then all of a sudden, Virginia Tech, Clemson, Duke, Syracuse, and Michigan State, they started playing much more difficult defenses. 4 of the 5 there are in the top 39, and he started to struggle, and you see that in the stats. So top 25 defenses, he had a passer rating of 97.7. Just power 5 teams, he was at 126.6, and then they played 6 teams where the defense was 75th or worse, and he had a passer rating of 160. So he really ate up the guys who were bad and struggled against the teams that were good. And those splits are important, because the interesting thing is when you look at Florida, those splits are much less pronounced when you look at Kyle Trask. And so, you know, I think Newman has probably the higher ceiling than Trask does. I think Trask is much more consistent. The other thing is that Trask has been in that game now against Georgia in Jacksonville, experienced the whole thing. And I suspect he's going to be more ready than he was this past year for it. And Newman's going to be experiencing that for the first time. I mean, there is a difference between the SEC and being at Wake Forest, right? There are no expectations at Wake Forest. You go 6-5, 6-6. Everybody pats you on the back, says, "Oh, you did a great job." You go, you know, 3-9, they say, "Wait till next year." And if you go 9-3, they're about ready to build a statue for you. You go 9-3 at Georgia, they're going to run you out of town. So it's a different level of pressure. It's going to be interesting to see how he can deal with it.
Yeah, hopefully that experience for Trask leads to the right wristbands for the game. So
that would be useful.
Oh man, I just, you know, it does hurt, but I'll play around with it a little bit. Got to have some fun with it.
It'll make it much more sweet when they win this year.
Exactly. So, all right, before we wrap up here, let's get in discussion here for, you know, Mullen hopeful for football to start in the fall. He met with the media on Zoom this past Monday. First time we've been able to talk to Mullen since about mid-March, the week before spring football practice was supposed to start. He said he's more hopeful than optimistic that there will be a season this fall, but it's hard to project, you know, where the world will be in 4 months from now. Something that can play a part in that is he thinks the consensus among SEC coaches is that they would prefer to have 8 weeks to prepare for prepare their players for a season. He thinks everybody would be comfortable with 6 weeks if needed. He said he wouldn't mind only having 4 weeks of practice before the season if they're able to get the players in the weight room for a few weeks in advance. He did say, you know, 4 weeks would be really, really pushing it. I do agree with him on that part. So, you know, Will, first time we get to talk to him, he kind of mentioned and talked a lot about, you know, what just that's just the sport that we love to cover so much, you know, what it means out there to everybody who, you know, gets together in the swamp and tailgates every week and all that good stuff. And, you know, he got a little emotional, sentimental, you know, not choke up crying or anything like that, but you know, you could tell, you know, he knows how much this game of college football means to the fan base, means to the students out there. Especially, I think how much it means to us too, to be able to talk about it every week and have a show and write about it as well. But you know, just kind of, you know, he's been in discussions, of course, with ADs and other college coaches out there, and you know, they have a timeline of 8 weeks, 6 weeks, 4 weeks that they've discussed. So you know, it does you know, lead you to believe that he is also in these conversations. And when he speaks, you know, I think we do need to listen about, you know, the whole hopeful more than optimistic. I think that is kind of a leeway that we may not get a start point that we are accustomed to that first week of September, but hopefully have a somewhat football season somewhere in the fall.
Yeah, man, I think we need to take a step back and say, all right, the PGA Tour is going to start up sometime in June. The NBA is talking about coming back and figuring out how to play their season, you know, potentially coming back middle of May, getting those guys in camp. College football is going to have to see how that goes with those organizations and the setbacks they see and the challenges they have to understand what they're going to be able to do and what they're not going to be able to do, right? And we're going to have to see how the virus reacts and is there a second wave and all those sorts of things before you can really put any sort of certainty on what you're doing. I do know that I appreciate that he's pushing for at least 6 weeks with a couple of weeks in the weight room before that. I do think that if you throw guys out there without allowing them to truly prepare physically, you're really asking for some problems as the guys get beat up in an entire SEC schedule. So I'm glad to see him asking for that. But, you know, 8 weeks, if you're going to start the season first week in September, means you're really getting in there. Second week in July is what you're, maybe even first week in July is what you're talking about getting in there for camp. One, it's really hot, so it's good to get an indoor practice facility. But the other thing is that it's just, it's going to be a long season for the players to have 8 weeks of camp and then go all the way through a full season. I'm doubtful that we have that early September start. I don't like saying that, but I think that's probably what ends up happening. I think things might get pushed back a little bit, but then you run up against the moral problem of having players play till like February or March and then come back the next year in September to play again. So I do think that there's probably going to be some concessions that need to be made, but you know, like I said, we're not going to know until we see with Major League Baseball, until we see with the NBA, PGA Tour, you know, even UFC is going to be opening up and doing some stuff in Florida as well. So
yeah, here in Jacksonville. So yeah.
And then you've got general hotspots, right? Mm-hmm. And so the SEC in general has been relatively light when it comes to the coronavirus. I mean, as opposed to, you know, a team like Penn State, Pennsylvania's been hit reasonably hard. New York has been hit. Like, how do you play the Big Ten? Like, how do you do Rutgers, right? If you're playing the Big Ten, that's a bigger challenge maybe than getting Alabama to play Auburn. And so maybe they'll have to make some manipulations there. But Mullen's right about what college football means to people. means to people. I mean, I'm missing sports in general, but one of the things I'm missing is that college football just never really stops. And, you know, there's nothing to argue about right now. It's everything is sort of stopped. And, you know, every once in a while a recruit pops or something like that. But
we got to argue draft picks this week.
and it was a welcome respite from basically saying the same stuff we've been saying for about 6 weeks. Right. And the thing is that, the people that you tailgate with, the people that you spend time with, the people that you bond over this become your friends and become your family. And so that's really what you're losing when, especially for college football, right? I mean, the people that I talk to from college aren't the people I went through engineering classes with for the most part. They're people I went to football games with. And, you know, the same thing applies now that we're doing this, is that the people that I talk to on a day-to-day basis to sort of keep me anchored with the University of Florida are people who have a love for the football program and a desire to see it do well. And so those are the things that you're missing when the college football season either gets delayed or if they have to play games without fans or those sorts of things, is, you know, the tailgates, the experience, sort of the familial aspect of college football that I really think makes it unique and different from the other sports that are out there.
Yeah, believe me, as fun as the Zoom Harmonic Woods tailgates are, I'm missing the big bass drum. Doesn't get to happen on a Zoom meeting.
Well, I don't know. We are going to have to come up with a definition of whether drinking on a Zoom meeting makes you an alcoholic or not. But
a lot of people are doing it. So
I don't think that's drinking at home alone. I think that's drinking with your friends virtually. So we'll give you a pass.
Right. That's what we're doing now. So just the nature of the business right now. So a little bit of football part of this, Will, before dealing with Mullen and what he was talking to us about here is, you know, key is to maximize the opportunity here that they have now and not dwell on what they're missing. Anthony Richardson, of course, early enrollee quarterback was brought up. And, you know, Mullen says, you know, he has more time available to hit the field and throw now than he normally would have during this time with classes and strength conditioning workouts. So, you know, extending that, I got to ask Mullen if there was any positives that he can take away from what's going on right now. And he said, you know, how the team is handling the adversity of all this, and he likes where they're at with that part of it. You know, teams handle adversity all the time, and this is just one more piece there. So the team's mindset's with all the uncertainty, quote, you know, the big thing is when all this is over, are we going to be the team that's prepared to go? And I think that's a worry there for all these college football coaches out there. Are these players doing what they're supposed to do? You can't be there with them. You're going to have to rely on, you know, their word, their mouth to tell you the truth here. So, you know, he said they have high expectations within the program, but he doesn't know if the lockdown will necessarily give them advantage over other teams, kind of for what we've mentioned here. You know, the coaches coming back. You have almost the entire staff returning, you know, except for Tim Brewster here. Kyle Trask is returning, and a lot of production in key spots still returning for Florida. But Mullen says he's not necessarily sure that gives him them advantage right now. He's pleased with how his players are learning, and the feedback he's gotten from them, quote, I think our guys are handling it as well as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's knowing the guys you can trust, knowing the guys you can go to war with is really what comes out of something like this. If you're going to think about something being an advantage, right, is you're going to know, you know, if Trask steps up into a leadership position, if there's an issue that needs to be taken care of and he takes care of it, you're going to know if guys come in and they know the playbook backwards and forwards so that you can do the physical reps because you don't necessarily have to teach them things during install. You know, you'll know if the offensive linemen have progressed because they're much more aggressive and much more physical at the point of attack because they know what their assignments are and they know what they're supposed to do, or they've spent the time in the weight room for the guys who have access to that sort of stuff, that they've spent the time in the weight room to continue getting stronger. So, I think you learn who you can trust when you have any sort of adversity. And this is just one of those things where it's a little bit unique, a little bit different. It's not anything anybody would wish upon any program, but at the same time, learning who you can trust is a big deal, especially considering all the guys they have to replace. You know, on the defensive line, we talked about the two guys who got drafted. We talked about the four wide receivers. They're guys that need to be replaced. And the question is going to be, you know, is Kadarius Toney going to do what's necessary in order to take the next step? Same thing with Jacob Copeland. Which one of the freshman wide receivers is going to be Xavier Henderson, or is it going to be Jamarcus Weston? You know, who are the guys who are going to step into those roles, and who are the guys that Mullen's going to trust when it comes to third and two in that game against Georgia? Who's going to be in there? And I think this offseason, more than any other offseason, is really going to dictate who's the guy he's going to be able to trust, because he's not going to have an extended camp. He doesn't have spring practice, spring game. It's, you know, we're going to have camp and all of a sudden we're going to have games. And so the guys who have built that trust are going to be the guys who get to play. And so, yeah, this is going to, it's really an opportunity for the players to differentiate themselves on their own. And, you know, obviously you wouldn't want it to be this way, but it is this way. And so that's what we're going to learn.
Yeah, one part of this, Will, and I keep coming to this, you know, nutrition is so big this time of year, you know, and being with, you know, you're on campus, you're with the nutritionist on staff, you know, and I know so a lot of people, you know, may gloss over this, but, you know, the nutrition part of this, I think, is huge. You know, are these guys eating the way they're supposed to be eating? You know, and a lot of these guys don't come from, you know, the background where, you know, you can go out and you know, farmer's market and go eat the, you know, the healthiest food out there. And I mean, they're missing out on, you know, the important, you know, nutrition that they're supposed to be getting while they're working out. You know, working out, I think they can get by a little bit more. You know, you can make something up there to go work out. You can go pull a car. You can, you know, make some makeshift weights. But I think, you know, nutrition, you know, I think is a big part of this that these players are missing out on now. And nobody's watching what they're eating. And plus, I think, you know, true freshmen or the early enrollees that were going to get a taste of what to expect in spring, now they don't, they still don't really know what to do. You know, they, at least with the players who have been through a previous spring or been through a season or been through the workout regimen, they can kind of, they know what to expect. There's still guys who are, you know, a part of this team who haven't played a snap, who, you know, some wouldn't be on campus until, you know, summer anyway. Yeah. But, you know, are those guys doing the workout plan, the workout regimen that has been given to them? And but they don't really know how to do it the way the guys who have already been through a spring and been through a season. So, you know, there's two aspects there with, you know, experience off the field and how to handle everything off the field. I think really can play into this and how far teams can go.
Yeah, you know, I'm qualified to talk about a lot of things, but nutrition probably isn't one of them.
Me either.
but you know, everybody's in the same boat, right? I mean, yep. Every program has the exact same issues. You know, some teams have a little bit less experience in Florida. Some teams have a little bit more experience in Florida. At the end of the day, when the pads get strapped on, nobody's going to look back and go, oh, coronavirus put us at a disadvantage. And so the reality is this is all part of, you know, people, you will hear people defend recruiting by saying you got to get guys who fit your system, you got to get guys who have the right attitude, you know, I want 3 stars who work as hard, you know, who work harder than 5 stars, that sort of stuff. I mean, this is where that starts to become important, right? Is having the right culture, the right people, somebody who cares enough about his teammates and about his own success that he's going to work even when he doesn't necessarily have to, because there's nobody screaming at him and nobody watching him. And so having those types of people in the program are important. So everybody has the same general issue. We're going to see. I mean, it's going to be fascinating, because you look at teams like Georgia, I think there's a suspicion amongst Florida fans and maybe even some Georgia fans that Smart has brought in an awful lot of talent, but doesn't necessarily always harness that talent. And part of that is discipline type things. And so, you know, is the culture that he's built there strong enough to overcome something like this? And I think we'll learn the same thing about Florida. I think for the most part, Mullen has done a really good job of building a culture at Florida. We haven't had any of the shenanigans that were going on under McElwain, or at least they've been greatly reduced. And so I suspect that's going to continue. I suspect the players will come back ready. And the guys who don't, you know, Mullen's built up enough talent that if he's got people who don't come back ready, he's going to have somebody else ready to step in, which isn't something he could have said 2 or 3 years ago.
All right, good stuff, Will, man. Of course, the Jamie Newman article just dropped today. Anything else on the horizon for our Read and Reaction?
Yeah, I'm going to be writing a little bit about recruiting, hopefully later this week. So, you know, especially with coronavirus going on, there's a little bit of trepidation around that. And with Wilcoxon flipping to Tennessee, I think there's a little bit of trepidation there. So I'm going to take a look, see where Florida is, take a look where they are in relation to where they were last April and what maybe the lack of an ability to really truly recruit may have on the 2021 class.
All right. There's Will Miles. You can find him on Twitter at readandreaction.com and on Twitter at WillMilesSEC. I'm the host of Gators Breakdown, David Waters. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.